let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is
an urgent national crisis, pointless destruction, tremendous onslaught, our very dangerous southern border, large organized caravans, war and investigation, the late-term abortion, socialism in our country, calamitous trade policies, so bad, the savage gang, MS-13, HIV and AIDS, the ruthless coyotes, cartels, drug dealers, and human traffickers, global freeloading, childhood cancer, the radical regime in Iran, the politics of revenge, endless wars. They do bad, bad things.
The president laid out the major threats to our nation in last night's State of the Union as he sees them. After that, it was Democrat Stacey Abrams' turn.
It is immoral to allow politicians to harm women and families to advance a political agenda. The LGBTQ community remains under attack. We continue to confront racism from our past and in our present. Racist words and deeds. Climate change. Let's be clear. Voter suppression is real. From making it harder to register and stay on the rolls, to moving and closing polling places, we can no longer ignore these threats to democracy.
Between the two parties, there's a lot of room for debate about what's threatening us right now. We asked you about it.
I think that the biggest threats to the U.S. in 2019 are the declining health of our environment.
Our current president's campaign of misinformation.
Tariffs that are putting American companies out of business.
Climate change, climate change, climate change.
Donald Trump and his family.
The loss of health care and coverage for pre-existing conditions.
Lack of health care.
Too little, too late policy on overhauling the health care system is horrifying.
Health care, climate change, instability overseas that pose risks to the U.S. Or maybe, like FDR said, the only thing to fear is
fear itself.
And that's where we start today on The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz of WNYC in for Tanzina Vega. Glad to have you with us. The president did a lot of things last night. He lauded the economy. He touted legislative gains. He praised veterans and survivors of tragedy. But he also outlined major threats to the U.S. Are those really the top threats facing the country? I have three people with me to talk through the threats that you and they say are our most serious challenges. Samuel Brannon is director of the Risk and Foresight Group at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome, Samuel.
Glad to be with you.
Umair Irfan is staff writer at Vox, covering energy, tech, and climate change. Umair, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And Alice Rivlin is an economist at the Brookings Institution. Alice, great to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so Umair, let's start with you. As you heard just now, so many of our listeners pointed to climate change as a threat, but President Trump, unsurprisingly, he often dismisses the dangers posed by global warming, and he made no mention of it last night. There's a disconnect there, right?
Yeah, there definitely is. There's a disconnect between Trump and his own intelligence chiefs. Last week, the Director of National Intelligence presented to Congress the risk assessment from around the world and mentioned climate change quite pointedly and specifically about how it threatens security, how it threatens infrastructure, and overall as a strategic threat multiplier.
Samuel, what's your take on that? Where does climate change factor in as a threat to America? And is it just a threat from a security perspective, or does it pose a threat in other ways?
I think just to agree with Umair, pretty much everyone in the United States, except President Trump and the Republican Party at this point, agree that climate change is one of the greatest threats facing us at a local level in our communities. When you look at the fires that we've had in California this year, the extreme weather events, very hot, very cold, lots of rain, not enough rain. And that has a huge economic consequence. The Air Force itself lost a number of multi-billion dollar F-22 jets during hurricane season this past year. There are countless examples of how the failure of the federal government to deal with this and to take it on, let alone the challenges that we have in taking on climate change, are already costing our economy a huge and growing share of money. And we've seen major reports come out in the past 6 months that have basically told us that climate change is happening a lot more quickly, and it's having much more devastating consequences that move to food and agriculture and lots of other areas around the world, causing migration problems. So it's really the greatest global threat when you look at it. That's how I see it in a constellation of other threats that include war, that include terrorism. And I think increasingly that's where the American people are.
Alice, politically, though, climate change has essentially stalled at a federal level. Could 2019 be the year that that changes, or is addressing this issue just complicated and maybe nothing moves this year? Or tell me, maybe there's enough pressure mounting in certain circles that something changes in the coming months.
I think the infrastructure program that the president touted is one way that we might get some recognition of the dangers of climate change.
I am eager to work with you on legislation to deliver new and important infrastructure investment, including investments in the cutting-edge industries of the future.
I liked his emphasis on the economy's going well, so we have a chance to move it to a new level. I think the biggest threats are climate change and extreme inequality. And the biggest threat to our economy is not really anything economic. It is the bickering and partisan warfare in Washington that is keeping us from addressing the longer-run problems and from addressing the mistakes of the past. We have made major mistakes in the past, I think largely in not being able to help communities that were rocked by globalism and technological change to adjust, and we need to work on that too. But if you had a major infrastructure program, it could be partly the things we need to modernize transportation and broadband and all of those things. It could be partly protective against the ravages of climate change.
Umair, the president touted his economic record during the State of the Union. I'd like to hear from you about the economics of the climate change threat. We mentioned it a few minutes ago, but I'm wondering what you see as the financial impacts of climate change that we may already be experiencing.
Well, we can look at some of the disasters that happened last year. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they put out an annual report of disasters. They estimated that 2018's disasters cost at least $49 billion. They're going to put out a new estimate later today. But that's pales in comparison to 2017, which was a record year for disasters, and they estimated those disasters cost $306 billion. Now, these are some weather events, but there were a lot of them were exacerbated by climate change. Things like rising sea levels, for example, increased storm surges, which increases the amount of properties that are damaged and destroyed. And remember, in 2017, that was when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. And in the wake of that, you know, we had an island-wide blackout that led to the deaths of 3,000 Americans.
Umair, how optimistic are you that we might actually see some movement in this Congress on climate change? Can it be a bipartisan issue in the next 2 years? And does the Green New Deal factor in here at all?
Yes, there's a lot of momentum building up for the Green New Deal. And at the local level, I mean, climate change is something that's becoming increasingly difficult to ignore. 40% of the U.S. population lives in coastal counties, so sea level rise is something that's right on their doorstep. And increasingly, what you're seeing is Republicans are being forced to come up with alternative plans. So the Green New Deal is coming from the Democrats, but some Republicans are now actively proposing things like a carbon tax or an innovation-based approach to cutting greenhouse gases. And even in the Senate, where Republicans still have control, we saw the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee say that climate change is definitely going to be on their agenda in the coming Congress. So while at the top of the government and the executive branch, you're not going to see much action, lawmakers who have to actually face their constituents are feeling the pressure to actually do something about climate change, whether it's the direct impacts or whether it's mitigating the future effects.
Samuel, what tops your list of the threats that we need to look at?
There are three, and they're interconnected. And honestly, I didn't hear the president talk about any of them last night. The first one is Russia and the Russian interference in the 2016 election. The more we know about it, the more that we see that Russia attacked the very core of our institutions. They attacked our relationship with each other in this country. It was a new type of warfare that we were not prepared for. The second is China, and the president did talk about trade with China last night.
And we are now working on a new trade deal with China, but it must include real structural change to end unfair trade practices, reduce our chronic trade deficit, and protect American jobs.
Really, when you look at what China's doing around the world with the Belt and Road Initiative, with its influence growing, with its ability to intimidate through its military power, with the activities it's undertaking in its territorial waters and beyond them, China is a growing global power, and it's only going to pose more of a direct threat to the United States and its allies. And the president really didn't talk about that at all last night. And related to that, and it's the third issue, the president didn't talk about U.S. allies and alliances. And he didn't talk about the international system, which right now is under extreme strain. And when I talk about the international system, it's basically stability in the world, the lack of war between countries, the fact that we haven't had war in Europe since the Second World War, the fact that more or less Russia has been contained after the fall of the Soviet Union. And all of that is under threat right now, not least because of what we see happening with Brexit in the UK. But basically, the United States in leading the world is absent from the stage. What you heard from the president last night is that we're going to pull up the drawbridge, we're going to build a wall, and that's going to solve all of our problems. And history, especially for a country like ours that's linked around the world and counted on around the world, shows that we simply can't opt out of our leadership role. And we did not hear about what leadership in the world for the United States looks like.
And that's connected to pulling our troops out of Syria and Afghanistan as well, right? And moving ourselves away from the conflicts in the Middle East, as the president indicated he wants to be doing.
It is. And in the Syrian case, we've been working very closely with Syrian Kurds on the ground. We've been working with a number of countries in the region to try to push back against the Assad regime. We did too little. That was partly the last administration and this one. And that allowed the Russians to move in and reinforce along with the Iranians. And basically, we've handed Syria over. But the president's decision to simply move out of Syria without really having set up any kind of stability for the people we were working there essentially sets precedent for the future that says to the United States, if you work with us, you might be on your own at some point. We're not there to stay and to help. And the same signal is being sent to the Afghan people, where we're negotiating a deal with the Taliban, basically without involving the elected Afghan government. And again, people who have worked with us since 2001, since the events of 9/11, hand in hand, we're now saying we're going to go home. We're sort of tired of helping you here. And that's in strong contrast to the decades that the United States has spent in places like South Korea and Europe after wars helping those countries.
Alice, I want to turn to something so many of our listeners brought up to us, and that's healthcare. President Trump listed lower healthcare costs as a goal in his speech last night. But are high prices the main reason why so many Americans see this as a major threat to the country?
Yes, in part. Certainly high prices of drugs, and the president's right to take that on. I don't know whether he will do it in the right way, but that is a good bipartisan cause to get control of the rising cost of drugs. But in general, it has been a bipartisan consensus on lowering the cost of health care by moving to different kinds of incentives for the health care system. Much of that was in the Affordable Care Act and has been acted upon. And I'm a little bit optimistic. Drug prices are still rising very rapidly. But in general, health care costs have stabilized. Now, that's good news. And we need to stabilize them further. But we also need to stabilize the individual market for health care. Obamacare, as they call it, is not going away. It needs to be expanded and fixed. And the Republicans are in a curious position there. They opposed it for a long time. But now they're talking about many of its virtues, covering people with pre-existing conditions. So I think there's a chance for a compromise negotiation that will give us a much better insurance market.
Does the fact that healthcare is expensive and drugs are expensive, does that contribute to inequality that we're seeing in this country and that many people also view as a major threat to the country itself?
Oh, absolutely. It is still true that many people are not covered by health insurance, and many states have not taken the opportunity that the Affordable Care Act gave them to expand their Medicaid programs, although most of them have. And I don't think the Republicans have a plan to take this away, but they need to get serious about how are we going to go forward with an affordable health care system for everybody.
Samuel, President Trump devoted a good portion of his speech last night to what he called a, quote, urgent national crisis at our southern border. What are your thoughts on that as a crisis? As far as risks to the country go, does undocumented immigration make your list?
It does from the standpoint of a humanitarian issue. We have been unable to deal with the number of refugees coming across the border, especially children, and the conditions that we're keeping them in. But that's really a crisis of our own making at a lot of levels. That's a policy issue. And I think there's a big difference between the president wanting to call it a national emergency and a national crisis. Mm. A national emergency is an attack on the country that's existential, that really you wonder if the country's going to be there tomorrow. This is not that. For the most part, these are people who are seeking better lives. It's a small fraction who are the violent criminals that the president highlights. The biggest problem we have in illegal immigration is people who come in and fly into the country and overstay their visas. They've entered legally, in other words, and then they choose to stay. So it's not a crisis at the level that I would say Russia or China or the threat of war or terrorism or a lot of the health challenges that the president mentioned last night would be. I think it's an extreme position that he's taken on immigration, and it's a political position that he's taken that, frankly, I think those of us who study risk and threats, it's not on our top 10 list.
Let me ask you, Samuel, about one other threat that we've heard about for years. Samuel, the president said that he'll be meeting with Kim Jong-un of North Korea later this month. Has the president effectively decreased the threat that North Korea poses to the United States?
No, we see no evidence of that. My colleagues at Center for Strategic International Study have a non-classified satellite imagery project where they track actively sites across North Korea and look for signs of activity that there's any slowdown or any change or any disassembling of missile and nuclear sites. And we've seen none of that. So far, the talks have yielded no result. And in some ways, they've really bought Kim Jong-un a lot of goodwill and internally in some ways with the South Koreans. He's seen some limited relief on some of the sanctions. He's seen some money move back to him. So it's really been a lifeline for him. And in return, the United States and the international community have gotten nothing. And let me be very clear to say that North Korea certainly is a threat that makes everyone's top five list. This is a country with nuclear weapons that's on a war footing with its neighbors, with the United States, that has missiles that can range the United States and territories, Hawaii and Guam and elsewhere. So this is a real national security threat. And the way that the president has chosen to deal with it has done nothing to move the needle on making us any safer.
Might the meeting later this month move that needle? Is that possible?
Very doubtful, and those in the diplomatic circles think it's very ill-advised to meet with the North Koreans with no concessions beforehand.
Well, that's a topic we are certainly going to revisit. Thank you all so much. Samuel Brannon is director of the Risk and Foresight Group at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Umair Irfan is staff writer at Vox, and Alice Rivlin is an economist at the Brookings Institution. Thank you, all three of you, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Ken Ebert from Ballston Lake, New York, and I believe the biggest threat is the division being created by the president's policies and his rhetoric. The divide between rich and poor is growing, racist attitudes are increasing, and voting rights are under attack.
Hi, this is Lisa from Verona, Virginia. I feel that we, the people of the United States and our government, are our biggest threat. We're unable to make decisions, do what is best for the people of this country and those who want to come here to live. We can't even agree on what is best for our environment.
I'm John Adams in Kaufman, Texas. I would say, number one, intolerance, racism, and domestic terrorism, that is, white supremacists attacking minorities. Number two, irresponsible statesmanship, damaging long-term alliances with nations that share our country's values. Number three, climate change.
It's the day after the State of the Union, and that means that tucked into the opinion section of newspapers across the country, you'll find cartoons of President Trump at the podium, some emphasizing his looks, some poking fun at his remarks, and others focusing on his tense relationship with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Editorial cartoonists have a long history in this country. The earliest political caricatures date back as far as the 18th century, but the job is changing, and the people with the pen are also changing.
The speed and the rapidity and the very few people between me and publication has just changed dramatically.
That's Signe Wilkinson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist and my former colleague at the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News. She started off by telling me what the process of political cartooning was like in the past and how much it's shifting today.
I would come in, draw off of the news that I read in the newspaper. I gave it to someone who would take a photo of it. Somebody else would take a velox of that, give it to the layout people who would lay it onto a page, which would be photographed, and sent to the printing presses. And it would not be out, obviously, until the next morning. And I would send it out via fax or mail through my syndicate around the country, who would get it days later. So, like last night, which was the State of the Union address, I drew during the State of the Union, tweeted them out before the talk was over. Uh-huh. And then today I'm drawing one of the images, which will be in the paper and online and on our site tomorrow.
You're like live sketching events as they happen sometimes. I mean, that's what you were doing last night, essentially.
Correct.
What about the political climate when you first started? Was the craft more or less partisan than it is now, or is it the same?
People ask that a lot, and it just depends what you mean by partisan. But when you're talking about a good editorial cartoonist, that person usually has a very strong point of view. Maybe it's a moderate point of view, but usually it is on one side, left or right, consistently. It's not that you can't criticize the other side or don't criticize the other side, but each cartoonist has a point of view, just like writers, you know, commentators usually have a strong point of view.
There are so few newspaper political cartoonists now. And one thing that you do is you don't just talk about Trump and national politics, but you're also drawing and opining on issues related to Philadelphia, where you live and work. And I'm wondering what the loss of political cartoonists means for those local civic conversations in newspapers throughout the country.
Well, in my opinion, it's a total disaster, of course. So all newspapers and websites should have a local cartoonist. But it's true. I mean, my cartoons used to really be parts of the conversation in Philadelphia, and they still are to a certain degree. We just had a big indictment of a local political figure, and I've already done two cartoons on that, and I'll do more.
Signe, you were actually the first woman to receive a Pulitzer for your editorial cartoons. What's been the experience of being a woman in this field that obviously has been dominated by men? And I'm wondering if that's changing.
I think it's changing. It's unfortunately right now for the kind of job I used to have. I'm on contract now. I used to do six cartoons a week. I only do four right now. But full-time editorial cartoonists are not, it's not a growing profession, mm-hmm. to say the least. So there isn't opportunity so much in that traditional model for new people to come in, whether they're male or female or minority or white or whatever. That's not where new visual social commentary is taking place.
Back in June, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette cartoonist Rob Rogers was fired after publishing a cartoon that was critical of Trump. Is there a line in political cartoons?
Well, that's not the line, I think. What happened to Rob is he got a new publisher, and the publisher had a different point of view than the previous editorial point of view of the newspaper, and he moved to change that editorial point of view throughout the paper. From what I understand from Rob and elsewhere, the publisher said, you can stay if you draw cartoons that I like. And Rob, to his great credit, said, no, I can't do that. So he was out of a job. They have hired a cartoonist who is more in line, apparently, with the publisher's point of view. And as they say, the person who owns the presses gets to pick the cartoons. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened to him. In the past, it's been my experience that newspapers generally hire cartoonists who are vaguely in line with what the paper's point of view is. So a cartoonist can do a variety, you know, can just go ahead and cartoon without feeling like they're always at war with the publisher.
Sure. The other threat to cartoonists is violence. I mean, people remember the attack on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo in 2015 over a cartoon. Did that moment change the way you think about your work or the way you handle yourself when you're doing your work?
Not really. I really do believe, despite everything in the United States, that we have a great deal of freedom of speech, and generally speaking, that's been respected. I mean, with the gun situation the way it is, no one is safe after an argument. But I have felt, particularly after the Danish cartoons in 2005, I was on some panels, some public panels at the University of Pennsylvania and the Free Library of Philadelphia that were open to anybody. And there were not armed guards at the door. And I did feel nervous going up and being on stage in front of, you know, several hundred people, and anyone could have walked in. But it's free speech. You do take some risks, and I certainly haven't taken the same kind of risks as what the Danish cartoonists and certainly Charlie Hebdo cartoonists and editors suffered. That was a total tragedy.
Signe, do you still love your job and want to keep doing it for as long as you can do it?
Well, there are days.
Well, everybody's days. But in general, I mean, do you feel blessed to be doing this thing?
Well, it is. It's such a privilege. I mean, honestly, it's sort of like art therapy, to be frank. You know? you get up, you have your coffee, and instead of just grinding your teeth and having to go book a psychiatrist, I can go up to the drawing board and draw away all my irritations with the world. And I hope that, you know, some of them hit receptive audiences and people like them, and that they become part of the conversation. And that, you know, it's really fun, actually.
Signe Wilkinson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist. You can find her work at the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News, and also on Twitter. Thank you so much, Signe.
Thank you, Matt. It was a pleasure.
And now to another Trump nominee, this time in the D.C. Circuit. On Tuesday, Naomi Rao appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee. If confirmed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, Rao would fill the seat left behind by Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. But Rao is facing scrutiny over her current role within the Trump administration, as well as controversial writings from her time at Yale. Joining me to discuss Rao and her nomination is Zoe Tillman, legal reporter with BuzzFeed News. Zoe, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So let's begin by getting some background on Rao. What are her qualifications to be a district judge?
Rao currently serves in the Trump administration. She leads the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which means that she basically oversees the administration's deregulation push. So there's a lot of talk of shrinking the administrative state, taking away powers from regulatory agencies, and she's been in charge of coordinating all of that. Before that, she was a longtime law professor at George Mason University, now Scalia Law School, where she was a very prominent thinker and writer on administrative law issues. She, early on in her career, had very prestigious clerkships. She clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas on the U.S. Supreme Court and has just been a prominent conservative legal voice for a very long time.
But she's never worked as a judge before, is that right?
That's right. She's never been a judge. She's written extensively on administrative law issues, which is a major part of the D.C. Circuit's docket. It's the main forum where if an agency adopts a regulation or does something and someone wants to challenge that, that goes to the D.C. Circuit. So it tends to attract nominees with a background in administrative law, but she has never been a judge herself.
So we don't have judicial opinions to look at, but we do have her writing about administrative law. So are you able to tell us what the policy implications of having her on the D.C. Circuit would be? What would her judgeship look like?
It's always hard to predict what judges are going to do, but we do know that generally someone who has this kind of conservative legal jurisprudence on a court like the D.C. Circuit will mean when a case comes up challenging a very big action by an agency. Let's take, for instance, the Clean Power Plan, which was a major environmental policy adopted under the Obama administration, where something really big like that comes up. We tend to see conservative judges siding against the agency, basically saying agencies should not have too much power. These are unelected officials. We shouldn't give so much deference to the agencies. It should be up to Congress to make laws. Whereas judges appointed under Democrats, more liberal legal jurisprudence, tend to see more deference to agencies as okay and allowed for under the Constitution.
Right. And she also got questions yesterday from senators based on the story that you broke about Rao's writings from Yale. Let's take a listen.
In some of my writings, I talked about the issue of rape and sexual assault, and I emphasized that rape and sexual assault are crimes for which men should be held accountable and that no one should blame a victim of sexual assault or rape. I also attempted to make the common sense observation that there were some actions a woman could take to make it less likely to be a victim of those horrible crimes.
Tell me more about what you found from her time as a prolific op-ed writer at Yale.
Yes. Even in college, she was a very strong conservative thinker and writer on campus and wrote a number of columns for several campus publications. And a couple of them dealt with the subject of date rape. And as she alluded to in her testimony, she wrote basically that women who drink too much bear some responsibility if they're assaulted. She wrote things like, if a woman drinks to the point where she can no longer choose, well, getting to that point was part of her choice. And these are comments that have, you know, gotten the attention of Democrats and some Republicans on the committee as well, who have questions about whether that reflects her current thinking. She also wrote about race, affirmative action, LGBTQ issues, really touching every hot button subject that a judicial nominee would be expected to address one way or the other at her confirmation hearings. And then the question was, does what she wrote two decades ago have bearing on her qualification to be a judge now? And she said some of the language she used made her cringe. Mm-hmm. She tried to explain that she wasn't saying that women are to blame if they're assaulted. But Democrats have said that they didn't really see enough of a walk back from her from what she wrote.
Zoe Tillman is a legal reporter with BuzzFeed News. Zoe, thank you for sharing your reporting with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's your takeaway for today. Thanks so much for talking with us today. I'm Matt Katz in this week for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.